If you don't like capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want?
And there is a great deal of new construction of new institutions, new forms, new cooperatives, new worker-owned companies that's happening all over the country.
This is the Gar Alperovitz Podcast, a regular look at the ideas of historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz as he explores strategies to democratize wealth and empower workers and communities.
The topic today is an ambitious one. It is how system change can come to America. And this is a theme that has run throughout the conversations we've been having over the last year and a half as part of this series. We have often come back to strategies for transition to a new economy. We've, on some of the sessions, focused in on segments of the economy which people have made the argument, if you could turn them, if you could have system change in those segments of the economy, that could be a trigger to overall system change. We've done that around the money and banking system, for example. We've done it around new indicators, for example. But here we want to take on the larger issue. And normally we've had four people throw out ideas in these sessions, but we decided this time just to have two, in part because we have a couple of people who've had the opportunity to do a deep think on these issues because they've been writing books about them. And some of you have had the opportunity to start to get into these new books. So we thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to let these two individuals, Gus Speth and Gar Alperovitz, actually lay out some of what they're trying to argue here, and then just have a chance for a really good discussion. We've got till 5:30 Eastern, and so we should have plenty of time for discussion. Gus Speth is going to go first, and we'll give him about 15 minutes, and then Gar will go second. We'll give him about 15 minutes, and then we'll just open it up for a free-for-all and try to get a bunch of comments, and then let the two of them respond and actually see if there are areas where they might have differences of opinion and let those play out a little bit and really just have a good conversation about this. I think most of you know these two folks, but for anyone who doesn't, I'll just say a word. Gus Speth is right now a distinguished fellow at Demos, and he's also teaching at the Vermont Law School. This book, America the Possible, is the third of a trilogy of books that have dealt with big issues around really all of them with system change kinds of issues. He was one of the founders of NRDC and the World Resources Institute. And he was also, this is talk about revolutionary patience. He was the head of the United Nations Development Program, which is the biggest UN agency working around the world. And it's a giant bureaucracy. I can't imagine heading this institution. But he did, and he was able to do a lot of good things with that institution during that time, including helping them measure progress differently. And Gar Alperovitz is the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland. He is was the co-founding principal of the Democracy Collaborative, which is based at the University of Maryland. And he's the author of several books that get into these issues. He's got another life where he's also a historian. But on this topic, most recently, the two books that are relevant would be American Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, which some of you joined a really good conversation about last fall at Busboys and Poets. And if you don't like capitalism and you don't like socialism, what do you want? The possibility of a pluralist commonwealth and a community-sustaining economy. So let's jump right in and start with Gus Speth.
Thank you, John, and hello to everybody out there on the wire. I want to talk about two topics, and I'll try to do it in 10 minutes rather than 15. One is, what are forces that could drive transformative or systemic change in the U.S. particularly? And the second question is, people have asked, if we're aiming for a new economy, how do we know when we're getting there? How do we measure progress along that trajectory? So let me tick off pretty quickly for you eight forces that that can drive transformative change. And one thing I'd ask you to do is I tick off these forces or factors. Ask yourself how far along we are in each of these areas. Are we just beginning, or are things progressing well in along these dimensions? One would be, you know, increasing numbers of people become fed up with the system and see the problem as systemic. See the multiplicity of shortcomings afflicting our society, and conclude that the problem is really a system failure problem. A second factor would be the proliferation of and deepening of crises. Crises can lead to bad results or good results, so you have to add to this proliferation of crises whether we are developing the capacity to use them effectively. But that would be factor two. The third factor is the degree to which the progressive communities are coming together, forging a unified progressive identity, institutionalizing efforts at sustaining coordination, building a common infrastructure to formulate policy objectives and strategic messages, and creating a powerful movement rather than just coming together for isolated campaigns. How far along are we on getting the progressives of all stripes together? A fourth factor would be envisioning an attractive future. Clearly, people will be drawn to a compelling vision of the future. Do we have a sense of what the future is that we would like to have, for example, for our grandchildren in 2050? Not only so this positive vision of what the world could be like, or what the country could be like, it strikes me as very motivational and central to getting transformative change. A fifth factor would be actually building elements of this transformed country, of a new economy, from the ground up. Are we seeing across America, all across the landscape, the proliferations of models of the future coming into the present and inspiring us, and seeing those models replicated with you know, new lifestyles, new forms of business, new forms of community revitalization, new forms of community transition. A sixth factor would be whether we have in place or could have in place transformative leadership, capable of basically telling a new story. Howard Gardner, for example, in Changing Minds, writes that leaders of large disparate populations have enormous potential to change minds, and in the process can change the course of history. And Bill Moyers wrote in a very interesting piece that America needs a different story. So he says, let me tell you what I think up front. The leaders and thinkers and activists who honestly tell that story and speak passionately of the moral and religious values it puts into play will be the first political generation since the New Deal to win power back for the people. That's Moyers. A seventh force for deep change would be whether we are moving aggressively at pro-democracy political reform and building the kind of popular movement that can drive not only pro-democracy reforms, which are desperately needed to head off this creeping corporatocracy and plutocracy in which we find ourselves, but also a movement that is aimed, much of Occupy was aimed at changing minds, at transforming the way people see the world and think. So we've seen the evolution of this movement. The eighth dimension, I think it's worth a separate item, is are we seeing the rebirth of marches, of protests, of demonstrations, of nonviolent civil disobedience, direct action, people putting it all on the line for what they believe must really happen if we're going to give a decent world to children and grandchildren. You know, I think we all have seen the effectiveness of such actions in the past, and are we, you know, are we seeing enough of that today, or will we see enough tomorrow? So those are the factors that I would highlight as potential drivers of transformative change. And I, in my little paper that I wrote to you, I quoted our next speaker, Gar, as saying that we have to remember that fundamental change, indeed radical systemic change, is as common as grass in world history. So wherever we are now in those dimensions of change, we don't want to give up. The second question, briefly, is, you know, it's been asked, how do we know when we've arrived at a new economy? What are some of the metrics by which we could gauge progress along the way? Well, I suggest there are three. First, if we really had a more common and fleshed out vision of the attractive America that we would want to build, we would certainly be able to measure much better than we are now where we are in achieving that America. So I think this idea of a compelling vision of a transformed country, and we, you know, the more we have that, the more we agree on it, the better we'll be able to determine how far along we are to getting there. The second is that we can, and this is kind of what these NET sessions have been doing, we can break down this overall transformation to a new economy into a mutually reinforcing set of sub-transitions, if you will. And when we do that, we are better able to measure progress along each one. For example, if we think that as part of that future, we need a new type of cooperation with new democratization of capital and wealth, as Gar has urged, you know, that would be one such dimension. If we need a new system of money and finance that's focused on Main Street and not Wall Street, then if we need new indicators of progress, dethroning GDP, I mean, these are some of the dimensions of change that if we break down and we can measure more easily, I think, the degree of progress if we have an agreed set of sectors or issue fronts that we want to move on. And finally, I would say it's somewhat tongue-in-cheek, we can gauge our progress towards a new economy by measuring the magnitude of the effort being deployed against us, the amount of money and effort being spent to prevent things from moving in these directions. So that, I hope, will help our discussion a bit, and I'm happy to turn it over to Gar.
Great. Okay, thanks so much, Gus. All right, we're going to shift gears here for a second. Let's put this right over in front of Gar Alperovitz.
Thanks, John and Gus. First, if you haven't seen Gus's book, be sure to get a copy. It is a marvelous, marvelous book and takes many of these points deeper. Wonderful, wonderful thing. It's just out, and Gus is around the country. So whenever you see something that he is an event at, get your folks out because it's going to be a big event for the movement building as well as for the book. I want to talk about something very difficult that I've been struggling with in terms of transformative strategy. And I come at it both as a political economist and as a historian. And the core denominator of system, historic, political economic system, is who controls the wealth. And it's a very obvious point, but people don't often look at that. So that in feudalism, it was the lords who controlled the land, and they controlled the action. In 19th century capitalism, by and large, it was a much more small business capitalism, and it was much more diverse. And the small businesses were largely farmers and small entrepreneurs. They're entrepreneurial farmers owning land rather than feudal farmers as peasants. And the structure of the 19th century until the last third revolved around that in the small business capitalism. In state socialism, the state owns the property, and something flows from that. We've seen the concentration and loss of democracy in that. We live in a system which is corporate dominated, corporate capitalism,
and tiny elites controlling the wealth. Let me just mention how tiny they are. The top 1% owns more capital than the bottom 95% taken together. That's who owns American capitalism. And if you look more at it, the top 400 individuals, people, 400 people, you probably get most of them in this office suite, own more wealth than the bottom 180 million Americans taken together. That's who owns corporate capitalism. So for me, the bottom line question is, in a transformative vision of the new system, how do you actually address the structures of ownership that are dominant in the system? And we can leave aside for this discussion what I call good guy corporations, and there are many who are interested in environmental processes and many of the good small businesses, but the core corporate structure is not particularly interested in the goals. We've got some allies out there, and as many allies as we can get, are not particularly interested in the goals of growing equality, community building, ecological sustainability, liberty, democracy. I mean, they're putting big money into non-democratic electoral processes, and it's gotten worse, not better, as with the Citizens United decision. So the hard place in the argument is, what do you do about the big, big corporations? We spend most of our time at the Democracy Collaborative, many, many on-the-ground projects, worker ownership, neighborhood ownership, land trusts, co-ops, et cetera. We spend a great deal of our time at the local level working on that, developing it, gathering information, doing the Cleveland Project, and that's terribly important to go forward at the community level. But the hard place institutionally is where do you go to when you're dealing with the system question. So let me make it even tougher for you. The way in which corporate capitalism was partly managed in this particular system and in most European systems to a better degree was an alliance of the kind Gus was talking about for various diverse groups of concern, plus another institution that had power, and that was labor unions. The power base of democratic progressive politics has had an institution, not just people. It's the combination of a movement and institutions that gave enough leverage to partly balance the system. This has been well studied by political economists. And in Europe, much stronger labor unions. At the peak, the Swedish labor unions were 80% of the labor force. At our peak, they were 34%. Here's the hard part. As most people know, labor has now gone from 34% to 11%, and in the private sector, less than 7%, and declining. So we need to do a lot of movement building. But the question is, are we also going to be building up institutional power side by side to inform and enforce a different politics and a different vision? Now, that takes you to the question of who owns capital in a different way. My own view is that most of us overestimate the importance of movements on their own. So even if you look at the populists, who most people look back to in great, the populists failed, even though they were based on an institution, the small farmer. And that didn't, in fact, achieve the result that we had hoped for. The period, the progressive era that most people also look to was a movement-building era. And most people haven't probed hard enough. The progressive era was radically different from our own era. At the end of the progressive era, the federal government was about 3.6% of the economy. Today, it's in the range 22%, much smaller. It was a different society. So we're going to either, I think, build institutions as part and parcel of the movement, and if I'm correct about this, and it's systemic change we want, they will have to be wealth-holding, wealth-transforming, who gets to own the capital institutions. And it is easy, I think, to begin to project building up out of the pain and difficulty in transformative institutions, land trusts, neighborhood corporations, co-ops, municipal utilities, et cetera, then they are developing all over the country, many of them also with a green edge to them, an increasingly green involvement. But the hard place is, are we going to be able to get to large corporations? And people believe you can regulate them, and I no longer believe you can regulate them. I think the question will become, particularly in the society where growth is for the first time a major question. For ecological reasons, up until now, the alliance that I talked about earlier has been based on growth. That's what the labor unions came in on. That's what the whole society, in fact, that's what black movements, brown movements, the entire society has been built on growth. And at the core of that was the large corporation and the dynamics of corporate capitalism growing. If we're talking about a system that actually responds to the problem of the need to reduce growth, and I think most people who are concerned with this are, large corporations are subject to Wall Street pressures to increase growth or they are dead. That is a powerful force. So ultimately, it isn't simply putting people on the board of corporations. Often, that is to co-opt people into the growth dynamic. Ultimately, you have to change that dynamic, in my opinion, and that means some form of turning them into public enterprises that gets them out from under the growth, growth, growth. So the question, if we're serious about the growth issue, is how do we get to that point? I think the answer may be, and I think we are in a very, very difficult corporate capitalist system, much, much harder than all of the others taken together because they have different histories and they're much smaller in scale. You can tuck Germany into Montana. How do we build up enough knowledge, power, step by step, city by city, state by state? So we do two things. We begin, as in the history of the New Deal, almost all of the major experiments that became the national New Deal programs were built first in the laboratories at the grassroots level in the city and state at the time, and then were transformed up to the national level. So that really important to begin developing institutions that are quasi-public, cooperative, don't have to grow, have a public enterprise quality in the cities, in the states, and moving to the national level at some point. I think that's one key element. The other is I think we need to talk about this. People have been afraid of the public enterprise concept, but I think that's going to have to be something we open our discussion to. I have just myself and our staff has been looking at that for the last 5 or 6 months intensely. And in fact, enterprises that are not subject to growth are beginning to be developed all over the world. Public enterprise is on the rise. There's a lot of misconception about efficiencies. But from our point of view, we'll need, I think, to build up the institutions, those that will replace labor or displace the corporation locally, state by state, and at the hard point, specific questions of national. So let me just give you a little bit more about how that might develop, and then I'll probably have finished my 15 minutes of a four-hour lecture, which is as follows. We know something about this from the banking crisis. That is to say, there are crises emerging in certain areas which can't be solved without massive state intervention. And virtually every expert that I know, left, right, and center, predicts further financial crises. And when that happens and the anger happens, maybe the next step, many liberals are for this, to break them up. Well, anyone who has studied the history of what happens when you break up big corporations and big banks knows what happens. The big fish eat the little fish and they're back at the same game again in another few years. So I don't think the problem of break them up and regulation is the end of the line. I think down that line at some point comes public banking, both nationally and state by state. There are 20 states that are now trying to do what has already happened in the state of North Dakota, public banking at the state level. So models that are public banking are one element. Another big part of the economy is healthcare. And I think you can make a similar argument that the dynamics of profits and costs and waste and inflation in healthcare are going to drive that system state by state by state away from the current model with great pain, great difficulty. But even many of the corporations are going to be forced to do that because they want to get out from under those costs. And the only answer there is public, quasi-public, Medicare for all, which is a public democratized ownership of the healthcare insurance system. So I think banking and healthcare are another two of them. And I think the other piece to look at is this. People tend to forget we did, in fact, nationalize General Motors, Chrysler, and the biggest insurance company in the world, AIG. So in crisis situations, I think down the line of the next two or three decades, those opportunities are going to be coming forward. The question, I think, in movement building that needs to be addressed, first, do we actually confront the need to begin to open up this very, very scary part of the discussion, public ownership, for the large ones to get at the growth dynamic? And if we don't have an answer to that, then part of the problem is us. We haven't been willing to face up to what do we do about growth, because at the heart of the growth issue is a different form of institution. So I think one of the questions that I would emphasize, and I agree with virtually all the things that Gus said, but I think we need to begin asking ourselves, in the models we're building, the local and state level, and as I said, there are many, many, many great things going on, but in our own discourse, in our own discussion, have we actually asked what a systemic design is that includes dealing with growth, where the growth is at its most powerful, powerful core, and that is in the corporate sector. And I think we do that, we're going to begin developing a vision that is radically decentralized to the communities, the co-ops, the worker-owned companies, the municipal, the land trusts, the neighborhood corporations, et cetera, and to the states. And there will be a residue of what do you do about the big guys, and some of those I think we have to face up to need to be in some form that actually gets at the growth dynamic down the line, or we will fail. We will have avoided the hardest part of the issue, and I think that is our challenge, and I think it's very hard for most people to come up to it because there's so much scariness about this set of issues. That's why I want to emphasize it for this discussion. Finally, as I said, this is not all corporations and not all small businesses. This is an argument I've just given you, by the way, that was made by the conservative founders of the Chicago School of Economics. They understood you couldn't regulate the big guys. And in the interest of small business competitive capitalism, they argued that some of these people, there was only one choice, which is to make them public. So I think that's the hard place in the discussion, and I suspect most of us haven't actually begun to grapple with it in the way that we as a movement need to do over time, with a view to building from the bottom, building the ideas, building the precedents, and then beginning to think nationally and regionally as well. Enough said.
That's great. I just want to congratulate Gar, too, that he actually took that very complex set of issues, boiled it down into 700 words, did the intriguing thing that he ended with there about the University of Chicago, and convinced the New York Times to publish it as an op-ed about 7 weeks ago, which is quite a feat. You think about the message that he just gave, quite a feat. Okay, so we now are going to open this up to all of you. Those of you on, I'll refer to it as the phone, but who are either in by teleconference or webinar, what you need to do is just shout out your name if you want to say something, and we'll put you on a list. And we'll take maybe, but let's just pause for a second and take a few names from people, those of you on the phone who want to say something. Tell me your first name. Okay, so we'll hang on there for a moment. Some of you I know are muted.
I'll say Cynthia at some point.
Okay, Cynthia at some point, okay. And then here in the room, and let me take names. I've got a quick comment question I want to throw in, but others here who are in the room, okay. Lisa. Okay, let me go first, and then Lisa. Okay, and then Randy's over there, too, and then Cynthia. All right, so mine linking these together is I'm looking back at Gus's 8 sort of forces that can drive transformative change, and one was the degree to which the progressive communities are coming together. I think that, in a way, I feel like I'm watching progressive communities come together in new ways, which is exciting, but not necessarily around a transformative new economy vision. And that is, I'll just give an example. A lot of key groups, progressive groups, are coming together to fight the big debate we'll have in this country in November and December about the budget and the so-called fiscal cliff. And they're coming together with a strong argument that is opposing the free market austerity argument of the right, and saying, no, here is a, if you will, a Keynesian jobs agenda to fight it with, which for some is a little bit green around the edges, but for most it isn't. It is the age-old argument of a big coalition. It's sort of what Gar described of the coalition of unions and other progressives that has dominated much of our recent history. And it's a really interesting question whether you could get that set of groups to embrace this broader system change agenda that also has saving the planet at its core. I want to throw out more maybe a provocative point about that, though, which is
I think, Gar, you were, you know, I'm thinking of Gus's point that you need a compelling story. And I don't think that the compelling story that will bring together the forces that we want to bring together, if at the center of that is a no-growth economy. I think we need to work on a language of the story that says what it is we want to build, that points out that an awful lot of areas where we want job growth do not involve the destruction of the planet. And we need to make that very strong distinction, which I think, I know we've talked, many of us, about this privately. I think Gus does it in his book, but it's being okay about growing a new waste management sector that saves the planet and creates jobs by shifting from incinerators and landfills to composting and recycling, that is for millions of new care jobs, which again don't have a negative impact on the planet, which is about a transformation of agriculture to small-scale, non-chemical farmers with a lot more jobs and growth in that sector, if you will, but in a way that is saving the planet. And I think there is the basis. And, you know, I'm curious, those of you, many here like Joe Uline, are in the process of trying to pull together the environmental community with the best people in the labor and social justice communities. I think it will be around a story that doesn't start with, that starts with the limits of the planet, but at its core has a positive story about jobs and livelihoods. And I would even argue to avoid completely, I think, the growth fight by posing it the way I just posed it. So let's take three or four, and then we'll come back to you two, and then we'll open it up again. So Lisa. And Lisa, if you could, I'm thinking of the people here, if you could maybe even come and lean over Gar's shoulder here. Say what you want to say.
Hi, Gar. I wanted to ask you about your timing. You know, you talk about 2 to 3 decades. And I guess in the climate world, that just seems like a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would love you to reconcile that for me. And then also, Rockefeller Family Foundation is having a symposium next week on how markets are now starting to bank on climate disaster. So what about the economics and the impact of markets that are already, I mean, markets are good at something. One of those things is usually foretelling trends.
But we'll take Randy now. And then we'll get responses, and then we'll go back to Cynthia in a second round.
Well, just a comment on your phrase, Gar, about nationalizing General Motors. When I think of nationalizing an industry, I, of course, think of it in more of a permanent sense. And that was a temporary nationalizing. And so it kind of just brings up the issue about sort of linguistic precision, which we all know that we need in our alternative model and this emerging narrative. But, you know, around the context of change, I've thought over years of something that I just informally called the 20 windows project. What are 20, like, paradigm shifting ideas that we could jam through the open window when the windows open up? And as an approach to change, you know, I think of things like, if crisis is key to leading the change, you know, are we ready with a public banking initiative to dramatically advance public banking over the sinister casino form of banking? You know, are we ready to, with some kind of an initiative that dramatically internalizes externalities, which is kind of the main thing that I'm working on behind the scenes with the Security Exchange Commission, and an idea around which how they would have to require all corporations to list all pollution externalities on their annual financial forms. But this 20 windows approach, to me, is we also need to come up with sort of these big ticket things and in various sectors of our personal passions, whether it's, you know, reduced work week for increased employment, or whether it's, you know, a death to industrial agriculture, or death to the slaughter logging of old growth forests. You know, what are sort of 20 big ideas around which they're internally consistent with this emerging new model?
Okay, so we'll shift back, maybe first to you, Gus, and that also gives you a chance to respond to Gar. And I should have just said, I mean, those are both those are terrific presentations, incredibly full of things. And so I'm glad we have a chance to unpack this now a little bit. So Gus.
Well, just a couple of thoughts. First, on the climate issue. The climate issue is so urgent that, you know, the deep changes that Gar and I have talked about, we can't wait another day, really. If you look at the information, it just floods in from studies every day. On how serious a climate crisis is. So I think the answer to that is that we've got to move in two steps, really, in two phases on the climate issue. One is to try to do everything we can, first with existing authorities, which I give the Obama administration some credit for, and get some new authorities to deal powerfully with the climate issue, and you know, try to do everything we can do within the framework of the world as we find it. The second thing is that I don't think we'll be able to deal effectively with the issue over the longer term and really, you know, achieve the 90% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, which we ought to be aiming for by mid-century in this country, and do all the things that we have to do to help the world meet its obligations, that we're not going to be able to do those things without the deeper transformative change of the type that that we've been talking about. So I think they're both parts are necessary on the climate issue. The second thing is just a couple of comments on the growth issue that John raised. It seems to me that what we want to transcend is the idea that we don't do things that we should do as a society because they're not financially, they don't have a high financial return. There are tremendous areas of investment that we need to be making that don't have a high financial return and therefore don't have the growth that this growth imperative seeks. And similarly, there are a wave of social and environmental and labor and other policies which are fought against because they would slow growth and are seen as threats to growth. And I think we've got to transcend that. We ought, in my book, I list a rather long list of public policy initiatives that I think are urgently needed that would have taken together certainly the likely effect of slowing growth, but they would improve quality of life and the health of the society as a whole in a dramatic way. And I don't think we ought to shy, you know, be turn away from taking these initiatives because they might have the effect of slowing growth. So my little phrase, for what it's worth, that I repeat too often, is that, you know, we need an economy that puts the priority not on profit and product and people and power, but puts the priority on people, place, and planet. And that's the new economy, and that's the economy we ought to be trying to build. And I think, you know, that framing of the issue, John, you know, doesn't rub people's noses in the in a kind of a no-growth ideology. thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, we're getting into the the meat of it all. So let me take them up as they came up, at least how I see them. Look, I'm trying to open up to our discussion what I think are the hard issues rather than the soft issues. And the question of growth, I certainly agree with what John and Gus just said. And everyone in this room knows, and everyone on the wire knows, that the major corporations are driving a growth agenda, and the labor unions have to go along with it in many, many, many other dominant sectors. However we want to talk about the language, and I do think we could do a lot better languaging than what I've talked about here, that's the dynamic. And we can avoid that, and we will lose. So I'm arguing that we up front better get at and face that piece of the puzzle rather than avoid it. And that means you're going to have to come up against institutions with very great power that have at their core the necessity to drive growth of resource use and also to pollute because it reduces costs and also to create climate change problems because it reduces cost. And the traditional model, I was Gaylord Nelson's legislative director. I did all the liberal kind of regulations and an environment that Gus and I have been talking about forever. Those days that we were able to do that are no more. That era is over. So either we build the institutional base step by step from the bottom up, but not ducking where we have to go, or we lose. The trends will continue against us. So I like John's formulation, I like the language, and I don't think we can avoid the growth issue. Okay, we tactically we talk about when and how and so forth, but this is an analytic discussion of the fundamentals. Number two, we don't have time in the climate change issue. Very good point. And my argument there is we don't have time and it will take time. You cannot do the kind of change that we're talking, which is systemic change without decades. You can't do this without throwing decades on the table. Now, we all want a shortcut, and there is no shortcut, which means a lot of people are going to be hurt and a lot of pain is going to go on. And here's the tough place, and let me pull somebody's tails a little bit. People aren't going to like what I'm going to say, but I say it with love. Those of us who say, if we don't do it now, we're not going to be able to do it, often stand in the way of the long, difficult processes that are necessary to get there. In my view, it's going to take a long, long struggle to build from the bottom up, which is going on. That's the exciting part. People are building all over the country. And it will take time, and we need to get beyond the discussion that we don't have time. That's very hard because a lot of people are going to be hurt. We do not have the power to make a solution in the time that would be right. And we need to understand that and then build through that period because it's the only path available. Number three, I agree with you about the language and nationalization and public, because what we did was nationalize them, bailed them out, subsidized them, and then gave them away. But the point to note is that in crisis, the possibility of nationalizing occurred in many, many sectors. We would have had the banks, most of them, because we had that much stock, but the administration didn't want to do it. So at some point down the line, these crises, in my view, will repeat themselves. And I'm interested in the way one way to illustrate it is when we are in position to build the next mass transit high-speed rail system in this country, when the politics of that is right. There are no capacity at all in this country. Minor company in Portland, Oregon. We assemble some European mass transit and high-speed rail. A whole new industry is going to be built with taxpayer money and commuter money. That industry is going to have a lot of jobs. That industry could be a public, quasi-public, worker, community, national ownership structure aimed at a process which would be an energy-saving mass transit and rail system and target jobs to stabilize communities. So that's the kind of vision that you might get, and I agree with you about the language of that. One final point just to mention, and many people haven't thought about this, but it was very hot during the New Deal, and it was very important. I think it's going to come back. A lot of the scale issues, people don't realize how big this country really is compared to the European models. It's much easier to organize politics in small countries like Sweden and Germany, which is a tiny country compared to our own. You can duck France into Arizona and New Mexico. You can get the politics organized. The answer in this country turns out to be regionalism. And the regional kind of ideas of the New Deal and the conservatives, TVA was only one model. Roosevelt wanted to do seven different models around the country because regional was the right scale, not national. So when you think about public issues, I think they're going to be regionalized, not just nationalized in such a big country that we have. So enough said for round two.
Great. Okay, so let's turn, if we could, for a moment to the phone. I know, Cynthia, you want to say something. I'm also aware that Rich Rosen, who's on the
phone has thought a lot about GAR's challenge of reining in the major corporations. If you want to add anything, Rich, that would be great. And is there anyone else on the phone who at this stage wants to say something?
Yes, Bob Massey.
Okay, great, Bob. Okay, so why don't we take you three? So starting with you, Cynthia.
Yes, I appreciate these papers and comments so much. I just have two small questions based on GAR's notion of progressive fusion and also Gus's articulation of the need to get out from under Wall Street's demand for growth. And the first question is, it seems to me that natural allies, although having somewhat different perspectives, but natural allies would be the whole movement of ecological economists or green economists. And has there been alliance building with those theorists as well as practitioners that identify as ecological economists who are also looking towards dethroning growth as the measure of economic well-being? And then the second question was related to this, the problematic of the language of no growth. Do we ever think about not talking about no growth, but simply, but talking about growth with criteria, like growth that accounts for environmental externalities, and growth that is carbon neutral, and growth that is pro-wealth distribution? Is there value of making explicit kinds of criteria for growth that works in the new economy?
Great, thank you, Cynthia. Rich, if you want to say something, this would be a good moment, or you could also wait.
Okay, yeah, I'll just throw out something very brief in support of GAR's focus on public enterprise, which I love. I think, GAR, you sort of did this in the by the by here, but I just wanted to emphasize to people that I think another good reason to consider public enterprise as part of the solution of various types, especially large public enterprise to replace large corporations, is they'd be much more amenable to democratic control, not just, of course, public ownership, but democratic control.
Great.
Rich, would you comment on how do you feel about your earlier proposal of bringing a public utility type regulation to the a much broader swath of the corporate sector?
Well, I still think it has merit as part of a transition to either more regulated large-scale corporations or to public enterprise. Because, in fact, I think my regulatory scheme of using PUCs as a precedent applies to either. I mean, in many states, in fact, the public utilities are regulated by the Public Utility Commission because there still are many public issues of great importance, particularly environmental issues that need further input and direction from a democratic body like a Public Utility Commission, at least potentially democratic body. So I think that proposal is still worth looking at for either kind of enterprise, public or private corporate.
Okay, and then next we'll turn to Bob Massey, who most of you know is the head of the New Economics Institute and helped lead this big conference in June at Bard College. It's great to have you in this sector overall and really good to have you as part of these sessions. So go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I just had two things. One, I, of course, admire GAR and Gus very much and appreciate their comments and support them entirely. One step I think I'd like to underscore is something we all talked about, GAR has been writing about, is this notion and that Gus talked about in terms of building progressive alliances, that I think we concretely need to be asking ourselves ever more intensely how we can help each other. With all the groups represented on this call. I said in my talk at the conference that really should be an opening question that we have whenever we converse. So And I think that once you start down that path, you can start to define things either regionally or nationally where people really can work together. The other thing I wanted to say had to do with the issue of corporate power. I think there is an opening right now, which I don't want to overemphasize, but I still think is a moment of opportunity of which we in the United States are not at all aware. I just came back last night from Amsterdam, where I am on the working group of an organization called the International Integrated Reporting Council, or IIRC. And the working group is the actual group that's writing the defining documents. The document I'd like to recommend that you keep your eye out for, it's going to be released, is something called the Prototype Framework. Now, the IIRC is a collection of the largest accounting associations in the world, the International Accounting Standards Board, the FASB, all the major accounting firms like KPMG, Deloitte, and so forth, the International Association of Securities Commissioners, and many, many others. You can look it up at CIRC.org. The important point is that in the framework document that is about to be released, there is a fundamental redefinition of the purpose of business, which is potentially, if it's really carried through to its full implications, has significant consequences. Instead of defining business as an institution which is primarily responsible to its financial providers of financial capital and has its main outcome the creation of additional financial capital, the framework document proposes that business should be imagined as an entity that draws from multiple capital stocks, natural, financial, human, intellectual, and so forth, combines those capital stocks in different ways to create value, which is another topic in itself, and then has output in all of those capitals which need to be accounted for. So they either enhance or deplete the capital stocks from which they have drawn. Now that is really, if you think about it, a redefinition of the model of capitalism. The big problem is that too few voices like ours are even aware of this. And so what's happening is the more traditional, you know, City of London, Wall Street types, finance people, and so forth are stepping in and saying, well, this goes a little too far and so forth. But it is a significant potential shift in the definition of business. I don't think it's necessarily revolutionary. I don't think it's going to solve many of the problems that that Gus and Gar outlined. And yet at the same time, I think it's a nuance as to where the international corporate community is going in its own definition of the need for change, which I think is important.
That's great. Okay, maybe just a quick response. I just wanted to add one thing before turning it back then to Gus and Gar to respond to this round. As I'm listening to everyone, I'm very aware that as we think of, you know, Bob just talked about how do we help each other, how do we pull together, that one of the tensions in the progressive community is if you think of, we've often said that the three big pillars of a new economy are greater equity and justice, one, greater ecological balance, two, and greater democracy, along the lines that Gar's just been describing, three. And it just strikes me that so many of the different groups we're talking about pulling together, Cynthia mentioned ecological economists, they really emphasize one of the three, almost to the exclusion of the other two. I mean, there are many ecological economists who are pretty unidimensional, and there are others that are much more diverse. But one of the problems I think we face is people will say, yeah, I mean, a lot of the people who are strongly in the social justice frame, for example, and will say, yeah, I'm for green everything. Of course I'm for green everything. But, and here's my Keynesian growth agenda, and yeah, we'll have green jobs. And likewise, I think what Gar is really pushing us to do here is get much deeper into the democracy part of it, which has to do with the ownership structures of the economy. I think most people who are deeply into either the social justice or the ecology sort of ignore or, again, pay lip service to this. And they say, yeah, I'm a member of a co-op, I'm this, I'm that. But they won't grapple with the deep issues that Gar is raising. So part of the question of pulling together a bigger progressive coalition is really changing, is helping many of the key actors who would be part of this understand that their piece, I mean, even Gar put it in stark terms just now. He said some of the people who are really pushing on climate are doing it in a way which could even be, you know, harmful to this longer term thing. So it's that to me is the hard part of this. I can see on paper what the coalition looks like. And many of the people who I think could make it up are my friends and are the friends of many of you. And yet I feel as though most of them aren't ready to make a commitment that's deep on all three pieces of this. And but they could be. They could be, you know, they could be pushed to be. I think like one of Joe's goals in life is to get some of the best people in labor and some of the best environmentalists to really spend time together to see how each other's vision could complement each other better, and how also both of them together have a much better chance of success than each of them alone. And Gar's stark figures on labor union density are shocking in that respect. But it would be true if you piece together the numbers of people in each of these different pieces, none of them are anywhere close to being alone a force that can challenge what we're up against. Gus, Beth, with your dream pen over here.
It is. on ecological economics, I think we disagree, John, on that in a way, because the ecological economists I know have always, from the very beginning, from Herman Daly forward, have been strong champions of social justice and fairness and talk about, you know, sustainable scale and just distribution. And I think, you know, if you look at Herman's latest work, he has proposals for sort of bracketing incomes like you would in the military or in the civil service, and having taxes that ensured that. He talks about a new banking, a new system of finance in which the ability to create money is shifted back to the government where Lincoln wanted it, and away from bank debt. So these are deep proposals for change coming from the ecological economists. I'm not really, you know, a card-carrying member, but I will put in these words on their behalf. I think also you should check out two very important books by ecological economists that talk about the growth issue in a very deep way. One is Tim Jackson's Prosperity Without Growth, and the other is Peter Victor's Managing Without Growth. So they do deal with this, you know, much bigger issues than trying to move to a steady state economy as such. I'm just wondering out loud, you know, whether a phrase that we need to bring back into the present more than it is here now, but was there in the past, and I'll ask this to Gar, is economic democracy. I mean, is that a strong phrase that incorporates both, you know, democratic ownership of the corporation and democratic steering of the investment decisions in the economy? Does that help us? And I also wanted to go back to Randy's interest in the SEC. I think there's some very important things that could come out of a focus on corporate liabilities and required disclosures of corporate liabilities. And also related to that, someone needs to look harder in the SEC at the reporting of the asset value of all that oil and fossil fuel in the earth, which they're reporting on their books now, that if we did anything responsible about the climate issue, you know, would have a sharp decline in value. I think someone estimated it in trillions. So there's, I think that that is a very interesting area to be exploring.
Okay, Gar.
First, let me second Bob Massey on two points. One, this has got to be something that is movement building. It has to be y'all common how we help each other, because this is a massive fight. And so the conversation we're having is aimed at, from my point of view, how do we get deep enough, but also how do we begin to find ways to work together? And Bob is right about that. And again, the accounting standards are a real breakthrough. It's opening up a whole new direction that allows us at least to calculate some of these issues and think about it openly. So that kind of raises a larger question. Sometimes I think of the Chinese expression, we need to walk on two legs. That is to say, we need to do whatever we can do now, whatever reforms we can get, whatever projects we can get, whatever things we can do at the local level. There's a lot of pain going on, a lot of trouble. And at the same time, we got to walk on two legs. Unless, if we're serious about where we're going, we need to penetrate very deeply to what it will take. It's different from the alliance conversation we need to have and the tactical conversations. What are we talking about with each other? Have we thought it through? If you don't like capitalism, corporate capitalism, you don't like state socialism, what do you want? What is the model that would actually reaffirm and achieve and nurture the values we're talking about? How does it work? And I think that conversation is beginning all over the country. I just came back from Texas, and some very interesting folks in Austin, Texas, organizers, deeply into that conversation. At the same time, they're doing tactical things wherever they can. So it's walk on two legs, but I'm urging, and I think the point of these conversations that TS has organized is indeed to have deeper conversations all along, to push deeper so we're thinking it through. I think that's the second point. As to the question of economic democracy, I don't particularly think that gets us into the deep conversation, because what it usually means is worker ownership with worker participation. I'm an advocate of worker ownership with worker participation, but worker-owned companies in a capitalist market will pollute the same way because they're under pressures to grow and to pollute. It isn't automatic. So, for instance, you know something about the work we've been doing in Cleveland, where there is an attempt to help stabilize that situation by using some public procurement from hospitals and universities, but it could be a public authority, stabilizing the market in part, but also building community. They're linked together in a community building structure, not just worker ownership, a nonprofit and a revolving fund that aims at building community. So I don't think we have language yet for the model, and I don't think we've worked out the model that takes us where we want to go, but it is a deeper conversation, quite separate from the tactical conversation. They've got to converge at some point, but I guess I'm urging heavily and why these conversations are important, that we penetrate to the hard issues, the ones we don't want to talk about, but as I sometimes, a friend of mine says, you know, if you don't talk about them, they'll get you at the pass.
Okay.
I hope Bob Massey will make available to us this reference when it comes out. To the new standards.
Happy to do that.
This is Fran.
Okay. Others here, we're going to do a new round, and I know Rick wants to say something. Joe, Stuart, Kathy,
Fran,
okay.
And Rob.
Great.
And Rob Walker.
Rob, okay, wonderful. Okay, so that's six of you. Let's take several of them. We'll start with Stuart had his hand up first. The last round, start over here, and we'll move around to Ruth and Joe.
Well, first, thank you both for wonderful presentations and wonderful work. I've been trying to figure out how to frame this as a concise question, and I've been unsuccessful in doing so. So I'm going to offer it as an observation, and that it may be a useful one. And in some respects, it's attempting to sharpen a tension that's implicit in a number of the comments that you made, John. And that is that I think, I'm sure that there are a number of people, Gus, with whom you share this vision, who see themselves as, on a day-to-day basis, engaged in very tactical work where they think there are near-term prospects that are achievable, who come away from hearing your vision with enthusiasm and because they're excited about it, they share it, and relief because they're happy that somebody's thinking about it and talking about it, and they can return to their tactical near-term work with a little bit of a lighter conscience. And I know that you know, at least half, probably two-thirds of my time is focused on folks in that space. And I think that's fine, because we need to do what we need to do when and how we can do it. But some of that work and some of those strategies that have real potential to achieve near-term gain are also reinforcing the systemic obstacles that we're talking about. And so in that regard, it's not just a question of a willingness to commit to this vision on some folks' parts. It's a willingness to disinvest from some of the work that they're currently doing. And I guess what I struggle with and want to sort of just offer up is something perhaps we're talking about is how to engage those folks in ways that help to at least get the stakes of their decisions clear, if not get them to do things differently. I mean, I think that for me, that's sort of the transitional conversations and the transitional ways of building coalitions that we need to be struggling with. So I'll leave. And one other sort of slightly shorter analytical question is, you know, with respect to the proliferation and the deepening of alternative forms of ownership, do you see any particular kinds of forms in particular places that might offer more leverage, might be more important to be promoting and supporting than others?
Great. Okay, next to Ruth Kaplan.
Thanks, John. Maybe I'll throw a little monkey wrench in this, in that I hear us just talking about building the progressive movement. And I think we need to go well beyond that. And in some of the work on the ground, it's very important to do that. I'll give one example that's going on right now, and that is up in Maine. They want to build Cienbro, which is an ESOP, wants to build an east-west super corridor. And there's a lot of organizing against this in Maine right now. The legislature has already appropriated the money to do a financial feasibility study for this private toll road that Cienbro would build. In the organizing, it's gone from Earth First to the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the Tea Party who got to the governor who made him realize that he had to put the brakes on this. If we hadn't done that very broad organizing and hadn't had that conversation, then, you know, that conversation with the governor might not have happened. The other thing that I've said sometimes in other public meetings, but I want to repeat again now, is that some of the most radical work is being done by conservative Republicans. And this is taking on the settled law of corporate constitutional rights in local ordinances that say in our towns, corporations do not have these rights. It is being done in conservative communities in Pennsylvania, some in New Hampshire, some in Maine. I think that if we're just talking about building the progressive movement and we're not looking at what other people are doing, we're missing something really, really important. And just to very briefly say a third thing, we are working on a public bank for Washington, D.C. And as a part of that, you have to do a power analysis. And you also have to get conversations with the banks, with the local banks, because if you don't get the local banks on your side, you're dead. And so there has to be a language to reach out to local bankers to find a way to talk about our analysis in a way that it will bring home to them that this is actually would be a win-win for them as well. So that was just an observation.
Great. Joe, you want to come up to the, mm-hmm. just maybe over there to the phone so everybody can hear?
Sure.
So you lie.
Well, let me start by adding a different shocking statistic to GAR's, which were shocking enough. And that is that if you look at the manufacturing economy in 1958, which was the high water mark about there that you mentioned, labor had 52.4% of that part of the economy under contract, over half of the manufacturing economy. The economy that the contracts negotiated reverberated through everything else, the ones in steel and auto and chemicals, clothing, textiles, et cetera, built the middle class. So if you look at the trajectory from then on, of course, we know it's been downhill. But there also was a shifting in vision, and this gets to Gus's question about do we have transformative leadership? Where is the transformative leadership? We did in the labor movement before World War II, even a little bit after, but as that density matured, the leadership changed pretty dramatically. And we had a little conversation about this yesterday as Gus did his book presentation at the AFL-CIO in the president's room where we were sitting under these wooden carved busts of the various presidents of the AFL-CIO. You can look at the vision of Sam Gompers, who when asked what does labor want, said, we want more schoolhouses and less jails, more learning and less vice, more opportunity to cultivate our better nature. He had a beautiful vision. The labor movement of his time had a sustainability vision. Walter Reuther, same way, had a good sustainability, good environmental vision, labor and the environment. Not so much since then. We went through this period of the, you know, George Meany, Lane Kirkland, of really a, I think one of you commented on a co-optation of capitalism to all kinds of players in our society, labor being one of them. So to bring it right up to today and this question of transformative leadership and where picking up on Bob Massey's comment, which I think was right on, what can we do to help each other in this struggle to build a sustainable future? We have to frame a path where labor sees its self-interest in building a sustainable future. They don't right now. And there isn't transformational leadership at a national level. There are possibilities of that at local and regional levels. We see it all the time. We've done a power structure analysis of the labor movement where we've identified the top 500 movers and shakers around the country, done bios on 250 of them, and one of our missions is to reach all of them, give them the information, help empower them, first on climate change because it is pressing and urgent, and second on the issues that y'all are raising. So one way we can help you is through the information we've gathered and connecting local efforts with visionary labor leaders. And one way you can help us is with the information that we need to get into the hands of these transformational leaders to help them become more effective. So I just throw that out as a kind of a request, really, and how we can help one another.
That's great. Okay, so let's hold on to Fran and Rob and Kathy. Let Gus and Gar toss in any thoughts to those three comments first.
Well, I want to comment on some thoughts that were stimulated by Stuart's comments. I think about the issues you raised in the context, particularly of my own tribe, the environmentalists, and I've been spending a lot of time with them over the recent past. And I have argued that they aren't investing. They're investing overwhelmingly in the tactical approach that you mentioned, and not too very significantly at all in the deep new economy or deeper change or transformative change. And I've urged them to strike a new balance, not to abandon the wonderful work they're doing, but to find a way to rebalance what they're doing so that they're complementing their near-term efforts with, you know, efforts on deeper change. It may be, though, these animals are so different that they require different organizations to do, in a way, different that. And that's one reason that I'm happy to see Bob Massey and others, Sarah Stranahan and others who are working to develop the new economy themes in different organizations. And of course, IPS has been doing that and others. Because I did get, you know, some pushback. My friends say, well, you know, if we embrace some of this, it's going to come at a cost, not just investment of financial resources, but it's going to cost us politically. We won't be able to do the tactical things as successfully if we embrace these initiatives that you're describing, Gus. My answer is that I think that the groups that have established patterns of contacts with people who can finance things, you know, that have tremendous fundraising capacity, really ought to apply some of that to the transformative side of the business, and help get, the efforts started. If they can't take them on themselves, at least get them started in new and different organizations.
Okay, Gar.
Just a couple of points, forms of ownership question that was Stuart asked. I think that there's a building movement right now for worker ownership. Everybody likes worker co-ops. You're going to hear a lot about Mondragon and the wonderful things that Mondragon has done, which it has. So that's a developing movement. Interestingly, and I'll come back to this, some of the unions are getting involved in that where they hadn't been involved since the latter part of the 19th century. I think, and I'm for all that, and the reason I'm for it is I think that the notion of transforming ownership towards some democratization, that's an idea whose time has to come. That's just a general idea. We need it at the neighborhood level, the city level, municipalization, worker ownership, cooperatives. People beginning in an American culture that doesn't talk that way to say, well, democratized ownership's a good thing. And that takes a lot of different forms. It's in the realm of building ideas. When you come down, so I'm for doing what you can do in that front because it's a necessary element of a long-term movement building and an idea building. Of the kind that I think are systemically more important are the kind that build a whole community structure. Worker ownership doesn't do that normally. Worker owners have very narrow concerns, and rightly so. They're up against the market. So these larger structures that are beginning to evolve, the one I described in Cleveland, has a broader implication for ultimate model building. And I think there's a lot of interest. Many cities are going in that direction, by the way. There's discussions now in this area, in Washington, D.C., and in Atlanta, and Pittsburgh, in Amarillo, Texas, in Milwaukee, Chicago. A whole lot of cities are exploring these more complex models because it helps the city and because it helps some of the players and it puts together a lot of pieces. I think there would be an interesting organizing model, we ought to talk about this, of activists, ownership, and labor unions, particularly public sector, because you can really build a tax base in certain cities in a way that helps everybody if you do it the right way, and there's some discussion of that going on. But community-wide interjects the principle of community. Let me emphasize this. Interjecting the principle of we are all in it together as a community is a much more powerful paradigm than the workers here get their thing and the workers there get their thing, or even neighborhoods. So if I give priority, I think it's to advance to that level. And I think we can do that. I think it's demonstrably possible. And I think organizing is possible on that. The second thing I do want to say about
and it ties in with several of the questions that have been raised. It's about this walk on two legs thing. We must do whatever can be done tactically now, but I don't think people have quite grasped the depth of the crisis. I really don't. I think we're in a historic, and I think Gus and I agree on this, we are in a historic crisis, not a tactical crisis. And if you say that, I'm a person who writes books and articles and gives lectures. I talk about ideas. I don't think, and I've often said, I don't think ideas matter most of the time. Power and momentum matter. Except when everything is beginning to be confusing and people understand there is a deep, deep problem and they want to understand it. That's movement building time that requires really coherent ideas to give people a sense of where we are and where we might be going. So that, I don't see people doing that in an organized way, really deeply engaging these issues as we're doing here. This is one of the very few places that's actually organizing to do that. And it's appropriate to the nature of the crisis. It gets us beyond tactics. Even though we have to talk about tactics, it gets us to strategy and systems rather than tactics and elections. And they're two different things. They have to work hand in hand. So I want to say that. And the third thing I want to say is about time. As I mentioned, I used to work on the Hill, both on the House and the Senate side. But I also worked with steelworkers in Youngstown, Ohio in 1977, the first big attempt at worker ownership. And at that time, the major unions were strongly against it, particularly the Steelworkers International. The local guys, that was their idea. The International didn't really like what they were doing. Now the steelworkers over time have come around and they are a big proponent of worker co-ops now. And SEIU is organizing and the electrical workers are organizing within worker-owned companies. So the process of transforming ideas within the labor movement is also part and parcel of this. A piece of the puzzle to get to these strategies. I think there's a real opportunity there if we were able to develop it. So enough said for the moment.
Okay, Gus, I think wanted to toss something in quickly here before we go to the next three, or were you, or was that like a nerd switch that I was as Gar was talking?
probably was a nervous switch. I was just thinking someone raised this issue, and I wanted to mention it to this group. Do people think that in the wake of this monstrous election that we're having with all the money slushing around, do people think that at the end of this there's going to be a moment where there will be a cry for reforming the political system, reforming the process, reforming the campaign finance, among other things? Is this going to be a precious moment that we have, come after the election is over, when people are going to say we're fed up with our political system and this takeover of big money? And is that something that we need to prepare for? If this is an opportunity, it affects both the possibilities of short-term amelioration and reform, and it also affects the potential for longer-term, deeper change. If we don't save our failing democracy, a lot of other things, almost all the great things we talk about and argue for, need a competent, democratically steered government. And right now we're about to, we've lost so much of that. We've whittled down our faith, our capacities in government, and at the same time, our democratic capacity.
So Francourt,
it's a question. Yeah. I'm just curious about people's thought on it.
All right, it's good. We turn next to you, Francourt, so you can throw out what you were going to say and answer Gus's challenge there, and then we'll go.
You
to
betcha.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that was a great setup, Gus. Tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., I'm giving a talk about Citizens United and the incredible momentum that exists across the country for some kind of constitutional amendment to reverse this horrible situation that we have. And, that momentum, I'm sure you're watching it too. We've even got the president saying we need to mobilize for our constitutional amendment. I hate to inform him, but we're already mobilizing. with over 300 localities and 8 states recommending this and more voting on it in November. So the momentum is definitely there, and I think whether or not we get a constitutional amendment, which we all know is a very tough road but also possible, there's so many steps along the way that I think the recognition that we got to do something is extremely high. And the Pew Charitable Trust just came out with a report that again verified that anybody that understands anything about Citizens United, 80% are against it, and that is across the board with Republicans, Independents, Democrats, Greens, everybody. So I think there's tremendous progress, promise there, and I think your point that this is a moment is well taken. Now I have a different reason that I raised my hand, and this is for you, Bob Massey. You talked about this arcane institution that most of us have never heard of, the International Integrated Reporting Council, and how it's got all these powerful players in it. And I was instantly intrigued with that because so much of my life experience says that sometimes things that look really, really boring to activists turn out to be incredibly important. And that indeed might be one of them. When we look at, you know, what allows a leveraged buyout firm like Bain to do what they do, turns out a lot of it's accounting. So my question for you is you asked how can we help each other. Is there anything that the media, like Yes Magazine, or the activists, or this kind of forum can do to help? Thanks.
Thanks, Fran. Hold on, Bob. Don't answer that now. We'll give you a couple minutes to collect yourself because you weren't ready for someone to ask about that. And we'll take Kathy and Rob, and then you can come in.
Thank you. I'm just really interested about all of these questions on a more international scale as well. One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately is food security. And internationally, it's just a mess because, first of all, USAID has been relying on public-private partnerships with huge corporations that are vertically integrated and are just like incredibly strong in terms of pursuing their own interests. And now with the G8 meeting, there was this announcement that this new alliance was going to come along, and that's not even public partner private partnerships. That's the new alliance of these huge corporations coming in to invest private funding in food security issues. And it raises huge questions about sustainability, about who's at the table when these projects are launched and decided on. And also, I mean, just really democratic questions, because a lot of the places where they want to launch these projects are in countries that are very young democracies. And so, you know, sitting at the elbows of all the parliamentary, you know, members of parliament are corporations and USAID that has a lot of interest in promoting these. So it's like there's just a lot of questions on an international scale, and what kinds of things can we be sharing with international partners that are struggling with these issues right now for something so basic as food security. And, you know, and then there's the land grabs and, you know, tons of issues that go along with it. So thanks.
Okay, and then Rob Walcott. Go ahead.
Well, greetings, everyone, and thanks for really insightful presentations and responses. Mine is a simple thought. I believe there is great power in advancing what we are for as distinct from focusing on the examples of what we are against. And I think that goes to Gar's point of operating at the community and regional levels and developing a variety of models with different attributes that suit the people, the culture, the economies of different regions. And this was certainly done in the 30s, the Appalachian Regional Commission, Rex Tugwell, Bob Nathan, really laid out a path of experimentation where there was variety, there was learning, there was participation, and there was the prospect of renewal. And that's exciting and affirmative from, frankly, fighting the growth argument per se again. I mean, back to the 70s, I've fought the Club of Rome agenda, on a pro basis, and you just get locked horns. The Club of Growth would love for us to take that position and to lock ourselves into head-to-head combat, and we wouldn't come out of it for another, 5 or 10 years, and I'm not sure how we would. Whereas if we get on the ground in Cleveland, in Pittsburgh, in Alabama, in California, with models that are measured, monitored, and continuous reporting with egalitarian distribution of information results, I think there's just great power in that. So I'll just leave it at that.
Great. Okay, maybe we'll turn first then back to you, Bob Massey, with your, and by the way, if you would send whatever you want to Noel on the IIRC, he'll send it around to the full list. But do you want to give a brief response to Fran's question?
Yes, I do. First of all, I want to make it clear that I agree with Gus and Gar's position about the need for structural change and for democratization, and I don't believe what I'm about to tell you is the solution to everything. But it is very interesting because I think Fran is right that sometimes certain boring mechanics actually determine structure. It's sort of how the financial industry was able to game us through credit default swaps and black pools and other technical elements that they were used to escape regulatory control. Just very briefly, the Prince of Wales personally created an organization called Accounting for Sustainability. He pointed out in meetings at St. James Palace, where he pulled together all the people who wanted to meet him, and said that current accounting had no regard for planetary limits, pushed the major institutions to come together, and has succeeded. I urge you to read the IIRC website. You need to read it with special Polaroid glasses because it does not use progressive language, but you can see that a lot is going on. That prototype document, to answer your question, Fran, directly, is going to be released and available for a number of months for commentary. It has important things mentioned, but only briefly, like climate change, planetary limits, the multiple capitals. That's actually very deeply built into it. And there's going to be pressure, going back to Gar's point about who opposes us, there's going to be pressure to remove those things. And I think that's the point where those of us who are interested in Yes Magazine and so forth could point out, we need to comment, not only do they need to be in there, but they need to be in there more frequently. It's just one pathway, but if it succeeds, it will change what accounting societies test for, what they measure for, a whole bunch of mechanical pieces that will have an effect on sustainability and perhaps a very deep one, depending on how things turn out.
Thank you. Okay, we'll turn back to Gus and Gar. Just one maybe observation listening to Bob and some of the other things here. I think the point that that Stuart was making, he used a term that we haven't, that others have not used here, which was transitional strategies or campaigns, by which he meant campaigns that lead towards the systemic change. And listening to these accounting reforms, to the public banking conversation that Gar and Ruth led, to the conversations about the Cleveland model, we think that there are a number of tactical things that are transitional because they get the transformational change. And those are perhaps what we're trying to get each other to work on together, in addition to this deeper conversation. And I wonder, going back to some of, Gus, your conversations with people at unnamed environmental groups, whether we couldn't find a space in some of these transitional strategies, and it might be things like what Bob has just mentioned, where we could get some common working together on these things. So Gus first, and then Gar, and then I think we have time for one or two more comments before 5:30 Eastern.
Well, very briefly, I like the phrase in that context of non-reformist reforms, things that look like reforms but are actually part and parcel of the beginning of deeper change. And I think the Democracy Collaborative and IPS and other groups are actually pursuing some of these now. And one that I know that IPS and others are working on that I'm very partial to is the whole idea of new indicators. Because I think if we actually had a different set of indicators and weren't all worshiping at the altar of GDP all the time, we would it would be transformative over time. If we had a genuine progress indicator that was widely credible, it came out quarterly, toe-to-toe with GDP, that would be a real breakthrough at the state level, at the national level. And I know that there's strategies that are being pursued now to move this along. And the more of a more fulsome dashboard of indicators that looked at other things, the status of democracy, social conditions, environmental conditions. So I think that would be quite transformative. There's good room for initiatives that bridge between that are transitional strategies in that sense.
This is Daphne. Gar. Can I get on the stack?
Yeah, sure. Gar is going to go first.
Yeah, let me second what Gus just said about the term transitional strategies. We spend most of our time on transitional strategies. And for those of you check out community-wealth.org. Put the dash in, community-wealth. And what you'll find, we've been doing this for many years now, there are thousands of change-oriented models that all change ownership of capital going on in the country. The press doesn't cover it at all. They don't have any capacity to do it. There are 130 million members of co-ops. There are 11 million people working worker-owned companies. There are hundreds and hundreds of land trusts, municipalization. All this stuff's going on, and the press doesn't cover it. And it's all growing and could grow more and more. So it is out there, and it's one of the things we need to do is get the word out. There are things that can be done that move in the direction. And also, not only substantively and tactically, but in terms of the idea system. They give people a different idea. And it's the Gramsci kind of Mannheim approach that the idea system needs to shift. If these are possible. And indeed, they're happening right now. So let me just go to one other question that Kathy raised, and then stop. I've been talking too much as it is. This is the one about the world food situation and what the corporations are doing and what AID is doing. This is, again, partly personal experience, partly political economist talk. I used to do some policy planning within the State Department for UN strategy. That was one of my other pre-break policies, what I used to do. And what you'd see is good folks inside the administration trying to do good things, come up with an AID strategy, try to put it on the ground, and by the time it hit the ground, the corporations had turned it into something else. Well, the lesson there, in my view, is you cannot, in fact, expect to alter what we as a nation do until we alter what we are as a nation. The power structure that we're talking about in all this conversation appears also in our capacity and policies internationally. So I want to bring back the global conversation to the very hard place. There are a lot of things, again, we can do tactically. But until we change the power structure that determines the big policies, it ain't going to change.
We are in a systemic crisis. That's another way to say it. This is a systemic crisis, not just a political crisis. It's at the nature of the power institution. That's a very hard thing to grasp because it means you want to play the game, you've got to throw a couple decades of your life on the table. You're talking about real power. Nonetheless, people, I think, and here I want to come back to what Gus was talking about. A lot of people don't like what's going on. They're searching for answers, and the political system, I don't think, is going to give them answers because it's too controlled. And there's a hunger for something, and particularly younger people. So I think this is, I'm a cautious optimist as a historian. I think this is the most interesting period of American history, bar none. I think for the first time in our lives and in the history of the country, really fundamental issues are on the table and are going to be increasingly on the table. And they're not going to be bailed out by a massive world war as they did in 1939, 1940, 41, because nuclear weapons isn't going to let that happen. And the crisis, I think, is going to deepen, and people hunger for answers that make sense. I think it's going to be very important to go along with the organism.
Okay, we're coming near the end. Daphne, why don't you toss out what you want to say?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. And it's been a real rich discussion. Thanks for everybody's participation. I just wanted to throw out a couple of what I see as very hopeful things that I'm going to be looking at with greater attention next week, namely, I'm going to be traveling to Germany and Denmark, both of which are in the process of moving away from GDP as an indicator towards a green GDP. The problem in the case of Denmark is that they're looking to the World Bank for guidance on this, so we're trying to get to them first to help them think through a different way of going about things, similar to what is being done in Maryland with the Genuine Progress Indicator. And I'll be traveling with John Talberth, who's an ecological economist who's been doing some decades of work on this. The other thing I just wanted to throw out in response to Gar's comment about the need for new institutions is one of the more hopeful models that's coming out of Germany is a cooperatively owned renewable power company. I'll be visiting with a woman by the name of Ursula Swadek, who has gotten 100,000 people to join together into a cooperatively owned renewable energy program, and she won the Goldman Prize for it. So, you know, I think new models are, and I agree that it's easier to do this kind of thing in Germany and in smaller countries than it is in the U.S., but I think we've got a lot of inspiration coming from European countries that we should be learning as much as possible from. Germany's also going to be showing Japan how to get off of nuclear power by 2030. Now that Germany has made that commitment, Japan is going to be following suit. So there are a lot of hopeful indicators out there, and we shouldn't lose too much hope as we look at the problems that confront us.
Thank you, Daphne. Any other any responses to any of that? I did want to also just quickly say to Kathy and Gar on the food thing. I actually, you know, as we look at places where the paradigm can shift and where the system change can occur, I do think globally that food, partly because there have been three price spike crises in the last 4 years, that food can be an area where people from different countries can come together around a major system change kind of push. And the fact that 200 million small farmers are part of something called Via Campesina and are pushing a small-scale, non-chemical agriculture model that is ecological, that has equity, and that has democracy at the center, and the crisis is as deep as what Gar described as the moment when big change can occur. I thank God that AID has so little money, so much less power than it did when Gar was messing with it, because I think our ability to muck it up is less than it was 20 to 25 years ago. All right, so this has been terrific. Thanks to everyone, and it's really great the broad participation also of many different groups in this conversation. But I want to just thank you all, because I feel like in many ways this conversation took a lot of different pieces we've been dealing with in previous conversations, and put them all together into a big whole. And I think it's an interesting challenge. Gar was sort of ending with this, how we make sure that this, we continue this conversation, but what are our strategies for moving it into some of our allies? And I'll just say that Gus and myself, a few of us have just had this conversation with National People's Action, a major grassroots movement building group that's been taking on the big banks. They want to get into a bigger positive agenda for a new economy. They're totally at the system change level. Jobs with Justice is in a similar space. The National Domestic Workers Alliance is in a similar space. Center for Community Change is raising these questions in their work. So it feels like there are a number of spaces where people want to get into this. And some of those that I just mentioned would have the same time frame that Gar just laid out. They see this as a long-term, you know, 10-year struggle. I think, and I will also note, and I'm, you know, some of the groups that are more traditionally in what we would call the environmental sphere, like 350.org, also raising similar big systemic questions, even as they look for these non-reformist reforms or transitional strategies. So ideas that people have about, you know, beyond these sessions, how to move this into different areas and different organizations that want it, please share those with Noel, and he'll share them with all of us. And in the next one, well, we'll have two more sessions, but the one that I think if people could put on their calendars, December 4th, it looks like that is coming together as the date to do that other big issue. Gus started yesterday with the national security state and the militarized economy and what the hell we're going to do with that. So that one, we'll tackle that one in early December. So thank you all, and special thanks to Gus and Gar for sharing their insights.
Thanks for listening to the Gar Alpervitz podcast. To find articles, interviews, audio, video, and more, go to www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.